Blog Talk Radio.
Right field, and hit!
Baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. Thanks, everybody, for joining in today. We're going to continue our wraparound series, 30 teams in whatever, 65 days. We're going to try to cover every single Major League Baseball team before they start their season in April. And we've already done the Orioles. We've already covered, the Toronto Blue Jays yesterday with Ben Nicholson-Smith up there in Canada. And today we're going to be talking about the Boston Red Sox, and I probably should have waited, to be honest with you. I'm a Red Sox fan. The postseason, the offseason, it's almost as exciting, if not more so, than the postseason. It's still going on. There are still a lot of interesting players still available. But nonetheless, it just gives me an opportunity, I guess, to talk about the Red Sox, not only now in January, but also as we get closer to opening day, so I can double up on it. I'm wearing my Red Sox sweatshirt today. And we're talking with Red Sox insider Sean McAdam. It's going to be a great day today. I love having Sean on the program. He's been on before. Officially, I guess I should be calling him the Red Sox insider with Comcast Sportsnet New England. But he's been writing in this area for a long time. He knows the ins and outs of the Boston Red Sox. So we're going to be talking with him today. Great to have it on board. Let me bring Sean into the program in just a moment. But before that, if you want to find the program, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I can direct you wherever you need to go. It's at CJMitch73. If you want to talk baseball with us, you can head on over to our Facebook page. It's a podcast to be named later. And if you'd like to listen to the podcast or listen to my baseball or read my baseball writing, you can head on over to minorleagueball.com. I post articles, blog postings, and then these podcasts also appear there as well. So if you're listening live, fantastic. But if you want to get the links, you can either get that in the Facebook page or you can do it over at minorleagueball.com. Or you can sign on to our Blog Talk Network. It's blogtalkradio.com/, I think it's just Bosco Nation. I named it Bosco Nation. For any of you Seinfeld friends out there, you know what I'm talking about. It's Bosco Nation. So head on to Blog Talk Radio. Look up a podcast to be named later. Sign on. You'll be alerted to the program so you can get that via email. But let me bring Sean McAdam into the program. And, Sean, I love having you on. I love getting an inside take. You're as knowledgeable as anyone out there. You do a fantastic job. And being up here in the region, it's for selfish reasons. It gives me an opportunity. I can gripe and not feel too bad because you understand what it is to be a Red Sox fan. I've got my sweatshirt on today. I've been doing the news and notes here. But hope we had a fantastic holiday. How's everything going on with you so far?
Good, Chris. Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on again.
Obviously the Patriots are the focus up in this neck of the woods, but for me, the Red Sox are the passion of the region. And last year, I want to start first by talking about 2015 before we look at their offseason and then look ahead and try to predict and preview what we expect from them in 2016. And this part of last season, I talked with a lot of homers and crazies on Twitter because, you know, when you're doing these kinds of things, you're promoting the show, you want to get the perspective of some of the listeners. And Red Sox fans can be as crazy and wacky as anyone out there. And they were excited about the Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez signings. And we've talked about it before. I was okay with the Hanley signing. I despised the Pablo one. At this time last year, and include the entire offseason, I'm not specifically saying January 14th, by the time the offseason ended, what were your thoughts on what the Red Sox might be in 2015?
Well, I thought they were going to be improved over the previous season, and I think I picked them for 84 or 85 wins, just over 500, and maybe on the periphery of a playoff spot, a wild card spot, although I did not pick them to get a wild card. Obviously, that didn't work out. I think they ended up with 78 wins, and only that because of a strong finish in the last month and a half when they played better and some of the young players began to emerge. But I thought they overspent certainly on both Sandoval and Hanley in terms of the money spent. but I thought they would get far more production from each of them and than they turned out to get in 2015. So I certainly did not see another last place finish coming. I didn't think they were going to be a playoff team or a pennant contender, but I thought they would be sort of pointed in the right direction toward contention with an eye toward maybe getting to the playoffs this year. Obviously, that didn't happen.
And going into this season last year, the one thing, I despise the Pablo Sandoval signing. I'm not even going to go into it, as I've done that in ad nauseum with you before. But it just, people were optimistic coming into last season. And let's just say the Pablo Sandoval signing and the Hanley Ramirez signings were both turned out to be at least acceptable, maybe even good signings. Let's say they worked out a little bit. And Hanley Ramirez did hit well at the beginning of last season. So that's kind of why I wasn't hugely against the Hanley Ramirez side, is that there is upside there. He can hit when he's hitting. It's just, unfortunately, there are other issues that seem to diminish that possibility. But let's say they performed reasonably well and had decent, if not even good, seasons. I wasn't sure how anyone could believe that this could be a playoff team with that rotation that they had going into last season. What did you see at the beginning of the year and towards the middle of the year that leads us to believe that, and we'll get into the David Price and the Kimbrel and the Carson Smith additions, but how much different do you think the staff is now based on what we saw coming into this season last year? Again, over 500 with what we saw that we've got a whole group of number ones as Farrell tried to ram down our throat. What are your thoughts on what they were this time last year there versus what they are now?
Well, I think it was, dramatic license to label that group a bunch of number ones. If he had said, we have a bunch of threes and fours, and if they keep us in most games through six innings with the offense we have a chance to be pretty good. I think that would have been a little bit more truth than advertising, but of course no manager is going to come out and say that his team has got a bunch of middle-of-the-road starters. But I think that's largely what they were. I think the addition of Price is certainly a significant one. He's the kind of guy that can, I think, impact the rest of the starters in the rotation and make everybody a little bit better. Certainly takes the pressure off guys like Buchholz and Porcello, who might otherwise be looked at as the guys that would head up this rotation. I think they'll be better. The emergence of Rodriguez in the final 4 months of last year was a hugely positive sign, probably the best development in terms of pitching that the team experienced last year. You know, if you have Price heading up this rotation and you have Buchholz as, say, the number two, even allowing for the fact that he's not durable and is unlikely to give you 30 starts or 200 innings because he's never done it before, and it's unlikely he's going to do it again or do it for the first time at age 31 or 32, but still a useful starter. Porcello and then Kelly and Rodriguez, however you want to flush them out. I think we saw some encouraging signs from Kelly for a period of about 2 months, but again, it's got to be done now over a longer period of time. And, you know, there's, I think, reason for optimism when it comes to the rotation. Rodriguez has, you know, nearly a full year of the big leagues under his belt. Kelly showed some signs before developing some shoulder issues down the stretch. I think with Porcello and Buchholz, it's more about what is not expected of them. They don't have to be the staff leader. They don't have to be the number one guy. They could sort of blend in a little bit and pitch with less pressure. So I don't think it's the best rotation in the league, but I think it's above average. And I think coupled with the improvements that you referenced to the bullpen, that it's a pretty good pitching staff 1 through 12.
Yeah, 1 through 12. I think that's the key. You have to add the through 12 in there. To touch on Porcello and Kelly a little bit, they both started really poorly and finished, at least in Porcello's case, I guess you'd say he finished acceptable or decent, whereas Kelly at times looked phenomenal. What do you think we learned, or what's your opinion on that progression from what they were at the beginning of the year to what we finally ended up with at the end?
Well, I think there's less up and down in progression with Porcello, other than the fact that this was a guy who mysteriously started getting away from the pitch that had served him best, the two-seam fastball. And whether it was the effects of pitching in the AL East for the first time, pitching in Fenway Park, decided that he needed to overpower people and be a strikeout guy instead of pitching to contact and getting ground balls, which is always what he was in Detroit. So I don't think there's going to be any huge transformation with him. If you're a Red Sox fan, you just hope that he stays with that approach and doesn't try to make himself the power pitcher that he isn't, but rather get ground balls, get contact, and be a guy that can win 14 or 15 games with a, you know, mid to high 3 ERA. There's some value to that. It's not worth, you know, $20 million and change on that contract extension that kicks in this year, but it's still there's still value to a guy who provides 200 innings and can, you know, give you that kind of season. With Kelly, there's more upside because the stuff is better. You know, we've seen a guy that can flash a fastball 97, 98. I think what happened with him last year is that he learned that it isn't all about overpowering hitters with your fastball, that you have to mix in your secondary stuff. And indeed, that was the thing that seemed to get him turned around the middle of the year when he came back from Pawtucket. Mixing in different off-speed pitches and giving hitters a different look instead of trying to overpower them and strike everybody out. That would seem to be a lesson that you learn before the age of 27 or 28 and before you've been in the big leagues for, you know, parts of 3 or 4 seasons. But if Kelly can maintain that, then, you know, he could potentially be a number two guy. It's all about being durable and keeping those lessons in check as he goes out and starts his second year with the Red Sox. But I think there's some reason to believe that there's more there than the Red Sox have seen so far.
And I think that's why they traded for him. And I think that's one of the things that's a little bit disappointing. And being a pessimist, which I think maybe a lot of Red Sox are, except about their own team, of course, I'm wondering if Joe Kelly can ever put it together consistently. With the Cardinals, they develop really powerful, good, fast, hard-throwing arms seemingly daily over there. It's like they breed them. Maybe they just gave up on Kelly because they didn't need him because they had so many of them. Or maybe they never thought he would become the consistent starter that his stuff does. It flashes really impressively, but he's never been able to do it consistently. And I've always thought command had something to do with it, but we'll definitely see. And he showed signs of it. At least he's showing signs. It's one thing to have a great arm and have horrible results. He has a great arm, and he showed extremely good results, especially in September, or before he went out with the injury. So that is intriguing. Let's move on to Xander Bogaerts. He was supposed to be an immediate star in 2014. And you'd have to say with the mess that year was, he was disappointing to say the least there. So then he kind of flew under the radar in 2015. The expectations weren't quite as high. And he went out and had a really good emerging season. Better than you probably should have expected in 2014, even though expectations were so high that season. What do you think we saw from Bogaerts, and how good can he actually be? What is a realistic expectation rather than the lunacy that we get when we see how good he did in the playoffs before his eventual 2014 disappointment?
Yeah, I think that there were probably some unfair expectations in 2014, given what he had accomplished at 20 years old, coming up in August, contributing in that postseason to the World Series win. I think people thought they were just going to roll him out to short and he was going to turn into some sort of, you know, Cal Ripken with 30-plus home run power and above-average defensive play. But it's not an easy thing to do to be at a critical position like shortstop and take over there at 21 years old and expect that you're going to dominate right away. And I think the Red Sox pushed the panic button a little bit when they brought Drew back. I don't think there's any question that moving Bogaerts over to third base there in May of that season, as they did, certainly retarded his progress and got into his head a little bit. You look at, he was starting to hit a little better right as they brought Drew in, and when they moved Bogaerts to third, he just flatlined offensively, and he just never was able to dig himself out of that hole. I think all the work he put in last winter in preparation for 2015 with Brian Butterfield, with the improvements they made on first-step quickness, on explosiveness, improving his range. But it went beyond that, I thought, last year. Defensively, you saw him, you know, the phrase you hear a lot now from evaluators is internal clock. So that if there's a slow roller, he knows who the batter is and how much time he has to make that play at first. If it's somebody he has to hurry with, or if it's a slower, older player, he can take his time a little bit more and set himself. You know, a lot of Bogaerts' errors in 2015 were throwing errors, and they were almost sloppy, careless errors where he rushed the ball when he didn't have to, didn't get himself set or balanced before making a throw. And I thought he showed a lot more composure and good timing and sense for the game last year. Offensively, he obviously had a terrific season. He was much better with runners in scoring position. You saw that he wasn't overwhelmed in those spots anymore. I think the one thing that we haven't seen yet for an extended period of time is the power develop. And, you know, you also hear evaluators say that with young players, sometimes power is the last thing they figure out. They make better contact, they identify pitches, they drive the ball. But sometimes the power doesn't come until, you know, that's the last piece of the puzzle. So for somebody who had single digits in home run last year, I think he's certainly capable of more of that. Whether he's a 20 to 25 home run guy as he develops, I'm not sure, but he certainly is capable of, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 homers on a pretty regular basis. And that'll be the next progression, I think, that the Red Sox want to see this year, the ability to, you know, to produce more runs, hit a few more homers, and be more of that classic number three hitter.
Yeah, and it's partially the fans' fault. I mean, when we see something exciting, and when we saw what we saw in the playoffs in 2013, you saw a star, the poise, and everyone kept talking about poise. Don't talk about how big he is to be a shortstop. It just, you looked and said, wow, this kid is so poised. He's taking these tough, you know, 3-2 pitches or working counts from 0-2 back to it. I mean, he really did some phenomenal, very mature things in that World Series and in those playoffs. And so we just expected everything, and it's just not fair. I mean, it almost sounds like you're essentially saying he's developing instincts, and that just takes experience. And we, once we see something we like, we just want it immediately, and we forget that, you know, guys didn't usually get to the major leagues as quickly as they do now. At least that's my impression. You know, Bryce Harper is now a monster, and he's like 21 years old. It used to be that you were 24, 25, 26. Guys' peaks were 26 through 28. So to think that Bogaerts should have been what Carlos Correa did last year, for example, right away, we should realize that that's just not usually the case. We're expecting too much, and this kid's really good.
That's a good point, Chris. You know, not everybody is going to be Mike Trout or Carlos Correa and have that immediate can't miss impact when they get to the big leagues for the first time. And it's worth pointing out too that it's a lot different making that kind of impact and being seen as a franchise savior in a market like Houston or Anaheim as opposed to Boston, where there is so much more scrutiny, media attention, fan expectations, call it what you will. It's a lot easier to do that on a low-budget Astros team of which not much was expected last year, even though ultimately they made the playoffs and had a terrific season. It wasn't as if people expected the Astros to run away or be even a contender for a playoff spot. It's different in Boston, and it's different in New York and, you know, Philadelphia and a handful of other markets where you don't do these kind of things anonymously. You don't get to learn from your mistakes under cover of anonymity. That doesn't happen in a market like Boston, and So sometimes it takes players a little bit longer, depending on who they are and where they're playing.
Absolutely. I think we could probably ask Kyle Crawford about that. We could go back and look at the clips of when people put up throughout that, when Theo Epstein made that blunder of saying bridge year. I mean, bridge year is not some incendiary term. Houston, until last season, was not just in a bridge year. They were in a complete and total tunneled disgrace, dumping games so they can get draft picks year. And in Boston, you say bridge year, God forbid, and all of a sudden people think that the team is not even trying to win. I mean, there is definitely a different level and a different volume in Boston. And people can say, oh, you overhype that and all that. But the fact is, it is different. It's a fact. It's playing in Boston, expectations, especially at shortstop, where we had Nomar Garciaparra and Theo Epstein has been trying to put an offensive player at shortstop forever. And so all of a sudden we see Bogarts and we just assume, okay, Renteria was a failure. The guy from Tampa Bay, I forget his name, who was a failure. I mean, year after year after year, they kept trying to pay shortstops to hit home runs. And all of a sudden Bogarts with his size comes in and people assume we're going to see the next Nomar.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not something that you do, as I said, with the protection of anonymity and get to learn from your mistakes and grow on the job and all of that. People, particularly after he showed the maturity that he did in the final 6 weeks of 2013 and then in the postseason, people remember, you know, taking that close pitch from Scherzer in the ALCS and, you know, how sure of himself he looked, and I'm sure he was, but it's something else when you begin a year in 2015 as the starting quarterback where people are expecting, you know, a lot more of you, and I'm sure Bogarts learned from a lot of that.
And if you were to talk to Will Middlebrooks, I think he'd say he's glad because he's engaged to Jenny Dell, but I bet his career would have developed a little bit differently if he didn't have such a great start followed by all those struggles. If he was doing that in another market, maybe Will Middlebrooks is in a different situation right now than it turns out he is now because he started his career in Boston.
Yeah, I that's a good point. Sometimes you don't get that second chance. Middlebrooks was the guy that hit 15 home runs in half a season, and it looked like the Red Sox had their third baseman, you know, a power-hitting third baseman, spoken for the next 10 years. And, you know, now Will Middlebrooks is on his third franchise and maybe getting a look with Milwaukee at first base and the chance to come back to the big leagues, but nothing is guaranteed. And it's a reminder of how difficult that or how steep that learning curve can be when it begins in Boston.
And let me ask you about, because this is a very young team, the one thing you see the Yankees, for example, trying not to sign older players and trying not to add these big contracts, or at least until they get rid of some of the other ones. The Red Sox not only signed a few big contracts or made a trade, and we'll get into the offseason in just a moment, but this is a very young team. For a big market team that can spend a ton of money, this is a very youthful team. As soon as you got Hanley Ramirez essentially out of the clubhouse and away from the team, and Pablo Sandoval was, what, sitting every couple of days or something like that, it seemed like this team's attitude changed. They got a lot of youth on the field. They seemed more energetic. And all of a sudden, they really finished strong. While they started horribly, and they ended up 78-84, the worst team in the AL East. But in the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, they were one of the best teams in the AL East. What did you make of that strong finish? Was it just a team playing out the string with young players trying to prove themselves when games didn't matter? Or is this maybe a sign of what we could possibly expect in 2016?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. I would caution against taking too much from what people were able to see in those final 6 weeks to 2 months because the pressure was indeed off. They weren't playing for anything. The season was already kind of washed out by the middle of August. The attention was on the manager who was battling cancer and taking a leave of absence. I mean, it really was kind of an unusual final 6 or 7 weeks. And it's different when you are playing those level games with nothing to play for. There's a looseness that exists. And you hear evaluators all the time say the two hardest months to evaluate major league talent are April and September because at times – guys get off to good starts but can't maintain it. And then in September, when there's nothing on the line, sometimes it's easier to have that kind of impression right away, but to sustain it and do it for a full season when the stakes are higher is a little more difficult. So it may be that some of those results were the byproduct of, you know, kind of almost extended spring training games in that final month and a half. But I think there is reason for optimism given the organization has. I mean, when you look at a club that can up the middle provide you with two young catchers, someone the talent of Bogarts at a critical position in the middle of the infield, and Mookie Betts, who could be an MVP candidate as early as this year, that's a pretty good foundation on which to build. And then, you know, you have some other players, still viable veterans like Pedroia and Ortiz. You have young players with enormous talent who haven't done it consistently, and guys like Castillo and Bradley. You know, an improved bullpen, an ace in front of your rotation for a change. So there is some reason to feel good and to feel better that 2016 will be an improvement over 2015, but I'm not sure that we can take too much from the results of the final month and a half.
And one last one about that before we get into the offseason here. Blake Swihart was promoted a lot sooner than you ever thought he would be because of the injuries, the Tommy John surgery to, I forget the catcher's name right here. It's slipping my mind. Let me get
Christian Vasquez.
Christian Vasquez, right. Phenomenal defensive player. Can't really hit all that much. Hannigan had some issues with health even, so Swihart was promoted a lot quicker than he probably, or the Red Sox probably would have liked to. But what did your thoughts from what you saw from him just early on?
You're talking about which catcher now, Chris? I'm sorry.
Blake Swihart.
Okay. Certainly he arrived far ahead of schedule and out of desperation when Vasquez was lost for the year, and then Hannigan was going to handle a good chunk of the catching, and he ends up with a broken finger in early May, and all of a sudden Swihart is rushed to the big league. And, you know, to look back over that first month or month and a half, he was over his head. You know, he was overmatched at the plate. There were things behind the plate, running a game, calling a game, handling a pitching staff. All those things seemed to overwhelm him, as you might expect for someone at 22, thrust into what was essentially the starting catcher's role that soon in his career. And this is someone that really didn't start catching until midway through high school. So we know that catchers tend to develop a little bit later. You only need to look at someone like Jason Varitek, who really didn't establish himself. You know, this is a guy who was a multi-time All-American catcher at a good baseball school at Georgia Tech, and in fact was named to the All-Century Baseball America team based on his college career, but it took him until about 27 in the big leagues to really figure things out. So, and that's someone with much more of a foundation than Swihart had when he got to the big leagues last spring. You know, when he returned after that foot injury in late July, you could see it start to click for him. Offensively, he drove the ball from both sides of the plate. He got more confident behind the plate and handling some of those defensive responsibilities. And by the end of the year, it was a valuable experience for him. You know, it didn't look that way in May and June. It looked like, man, they're rushing this kid. Is he going to suffer some long-term developmental setbacks because he was asked to do too much too soon? I'm sure there were challenges, and he probably did feel overmatched for a while at the beginning. But by the end of the year, he had made significant strides, and I think he'll look back on 2015 as a blessing in disguise, as rough as it was initially.
Yeah, and that's really the best way to do it when it comes to anything, is throw someone in the pool and let them learn and expect them to fail for a while, but hopefully they'll get their bearings and come out ahead and learn from it. Hopefully that does lead to setbacks in some cases, and Middlebrooks may be a case of that. But yeah, I agree. Swihart looked a lot better in September than he did in June and July, for sure. Let's look at the offseason now. They signed David Price and Chris Young. They trade for Craig Kimbrell and Carson Smith. And Carson Smith was a phenomenal reliever last year. He's a middle reliever. He's not a closer yet anyway. So I don't know if he's this big ticket ad that people are fully aware of, but he was one of the best late inning relievers in all baseball last year in his rookie season. So while Kimbrell and Price are definitely the huge additions, Carson Smith is no small addition. If he can do it, of course, if he can continue to do what he did last season, his strikeout per nine was phenomenal last season. But you look at it, and the biggest offseason addition has to be the fact that they changed the GM. They get rid of a draft and develop guy in Ben Cherington, and a guy who, whether he had full control and power over decisions, I don't know if fans, I've always had doubts about whether it was Larry Lucchino or ownership or someone else making a lot of these decisions as opposed to Cherington. You've told me that I'm wrong and you know more than me, but at least I thought he lacked that credibility that everyone assumed he was the number one guy. They bring in Dave Dombrowski. There's no doubt. When Dave Dombrowski's here, he's the man. Even if it's not true, everyone believes it is. And I think you see significant differences in the two players. I mean, in what they're allowed to do as far as that GM goes. You know, you see Cherington going out and adding Victorinos in half measures like Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez. And then you see a veteran GM like a Dombrowski, and he goes out and adds gigantic ticket price guys. But he adds a David Price, who's a proven star, and Craig Kimbrell, who is, again, a proven star. It looks like things are very different in Boston right now. And yet, I think the concern was that Dombrowski would come in and he would ship out all of the prospects. And he did ship some good ones in the Kimbrell deal. But what are your general thoughts on how different this organization will be going forward than they have been the last two or three years where, yes, they won a World Series, but we also had more last-place finishes in the last 5 years than we've had in quite some time?
Yeah, there's no question that Dombrowski has been given far more leeway and more power than Cherington ever has. And you need only look at the David Price signing as evidence of that. Only 12 months prior to that, the Red Sox had really sort of half-assed their efforts to re-sign Lester initially with a real low ball offer in spring training that I think sort of poisoned the negotiations from the outset. And then even when they had an opportunity to re-sign him after trading him, they weren't ready to go fully in the way that the Giants and ultimately the Cubs were and ended up losing him. Now, 12 months later, Price is a free agent and Dombrowski makes it clear that this is his priority. And John Henry and the rest of ownership say, sure, go for it. So the fact that Dombrowski was given the ability to make that kind of commitment and to do so with a pitcher in his 30s, and we know both the history of free agent pitchers in their 30s and John Henry's aversion to signing those kinds of players, that got submerged, and Dombrowski was allowed to make that kind of commitment, the biggest contract the Red Sox have ever given at $217 million. So right there, that tells you how the dynamics have changed within ownership and the front office. As to what to expect from Dombrowski, I think it's still a little early to make any generalizations. You referenced the worry on the part of some people that he was going to simply strip mine the minor league system and try to win now and perhaps not leave the team in very good shape in 3 or 4 years. That was sort of his MO in Detroit. Again, I think you have to look at the situation and see that with the Tigers, you have an aging owner in Mike Ilitch who has never won a World Series since buying the Tigers. How much of that, was Dombrowski under pressure to win now and forego any long-term development at the expense of short-term answers? That may have contributed to some of the moves he made. I thought that Dombrowski actually struck a pretty good balance this offseason. It's unlikely that you're going to address all your needs through one avenue. In other words, you're not going to fill all your holes by making only trades, and it's probably not a smart thing to do by making only free agent signings. So he did a little of both. The two biggest moves, one was Kimbrel and the other was Price. And in a rather revealing and candid statement by Dombrowski, he admitted after he was done that he had expected that that would be the path they take, that it would be a free agent to address the starting pitching and a trade to address the bullpen, and that's how it played out. It may be that in years to come, you know, Manuel Margot turns into a star for the Padres, or Javier Aguirre turns into a franchise shortstop for the Padres. But I think Dombrowski was looking at the fact that shortstop is spoken for the immediate future by Xander Bogaerts, and center field seems to be in good hands, or at least the outfield is in good hands with Mookie Betts as a foundational player. I mentioned earlier about Betts being in center. It seems as though they're going to move him to right with Bradley back in center this year, but the point remains that Betts is a guy you build around. So I thought, you know, he was able to get a top-notch closer like Kimbrel. And, yes, he gave up two very good prospects, but not two of the best five, and not anyone that positionally didn't seem blocked by the present Red Sox roster. So, you know, I would also say that judging someone after their first offseason is premature, and ultimately Dombrowski's success will play out here over the next two or three years when we can really evaluate what he's done and what he had to give up to get it done.
Yeah, and I like the consistency of it. I mean, if you're going to sign a guy like David Price and give him that kind of money in those kind of years, A, you know that those back-end years aren't going to be that great, that he's going to decline. So by signing David Price, if you're going to give him that money, I don't have a problem with it. As I've said, as long as a huge signing doesn't stop you from doing a lot of other things, then I don't care what people get paid. I understand small and medium market teams, if they commit to one big-time price tag like with the Reds, they've got Joey Votto, and they essentially had to get rid of everybody else because they stuck themselves with Joey Votto. Now, the contract for Votto was done years ago, but this is kind of the year that they had to pay the bill. They had to get rid of a good player like Frazier, who was under reasonable cost. They had to get rid of Chapman. They tried to get rid of Phillips. I mean, that team had to change their entire organization because of Joey Votto's contract. The Red Sox don't have that problem. David Price isn't going to stop them from doing anything else. If they want to go out and sign the next David Price, they will. So I have no problem with signing a Price. But what I do like is, like you said, not only do they have the depth where they didn't need the prospects, they were good prospects, but like you said, they weren't the elite ones. And those guys wouldn't be contributing. Let's say they become great players, like you said. They won't be meaningful contributors for 4 or 5 years. If you're going to sign David Price and yet keep those prospects, it doesn't matter, because David Price might be a number four starter by the time those two prospects come in and become, let's say they become all-stars. I mean, they'll be all-stars when Price is no longer really even a good pitcher. So if you're going to go for it now with Price, then also go for it by getting a Craig Kimbrel and be consistent and do it that way. Don't, you know, hedge your bets either way. That, to me, shows some maturity from Dombrowski. And that consistency, whether it works out or not, I at least like to see that it seems like they have a plan and that they're going forward with a philosophy that, to me, makes sense. And to me, that I like that. As I said, I like the Carson Smith addition. To get rid of an innings eater like Miley, to get a difference maker in the back of the bullpen, that's a small addition, but I think a pretty good one and an interesting move, all in all. Chris Young, not a big-time signing. You talked about some of the things the Red Sox might do, and we'll get into what their 2016 will look like in a minute. What does the Chris signing do? Is he going to be a fourth outfielder that bats against lefties? He's really a guy who mashes lefties but isn't that great against righties. But they've got all these outfielders, including some decent ones in the minors as far as prospects that may only be here in a couple years. But what does the Chris Young signing mean to you? Why did they do it, and what's his role going to be, do you think?
Well, I think they did it because they needed some depth. You know, I think everyone agrees that Betts is established as not only an everyday major league player, but a potential star, and maybe even a potential superstar with, you know, in time, a five-tool player. So you know what you have in Betts. I think there's still some element of the unknown with both Jackie Bradley Jr. and Ruzney Castillo. Certainly you like what both those guys provide defensively, in particularly Bradley, who is, let's face it, he's as good a defender in the outfield as anyone on any big league roster. I don't think that's hyperbole. I don't think that's setting the bar too high for him. He is as good as anyone defensively in the big leagues right now. What you don't know from him is what he's going to be offensively. Is he the guy who, you know, for a stretch of about 6 weeks last year, you know, slugged about 700 and had an OPS of 1.2, or is he a guy who struggles to hit over 200 and doesn't get on base and has been overmatched at times? I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. The question, you know, the question that has to be answered is where in the middle is he? A 250, 330, you know, 440 guy. I think they could probably live with that as someone who contributes the way he does defensively. But if he doesn't at least hit for at a major league average, then what do you have? And Castillo, in some ways, is an even bigger mystery. This guy's 28 years old. He's been in North American pro baseball now for a little bit more than a year, but the jury is still out on him, too. So to bring in a guy like Chris Young, who, as you said, mashes lefties, can conceivably play all three outfield spots, although probably more of a corner guy than a center field guy, but certainly if you've got some issues, he can play center field in the short term and not hurt you. I think we're at a point now in baseball where depth has never been more important. In the sort of post-PED era, guys are not as durable. You have guys who need some time off, who need some rest, who can't be expected to play 155 games the way they did 20 years ago. And so you have to have someone that can come off the bench and give you 200 or 300 at-bats in the outfield. And Young seems to be the guy perfectly designed to do that, who can contribute some offensively, again, particularly against lefties, and protect you at all three outfield spots. So I think in a best-case scenario for the Red Sox, that's what he is. In a worst-case scenario, he's forced into playing more regularly if either Bradley or Castillo don't produce, or if either one of them or Betts has any sort of injury that sidelines him for any period, that sidelines them for any period of time.
Yeah, I've never quite understood. I mean, Bradley didn't. I mean, his offensive performance before his hot July or August was pretty miserable, to the point where you really couldn't even have him on a roster. But he was still young, and I never fully realized why there wasn't more trade interest in him. I wouldn't expect Bradley to get you a star player. I wouldn't expect Bradley maybe to be the top of a trade where you make this World Series push for David Price and Jackie Bradley's the best player the other team gets. I guess I didn't expect that kind of return in a trade. But when you see a Denard Span and a Ben Revere or a few years ago Michael Bourne either being traded or signing the kind of contracts they signed for, I don't see why there isn't more value from teams, especially in mid and small market teams, for a guy like a Bradley. If you just, unless you give up on his offense and just say, the guy's never going to hit. And of course, if you come to that conclusion, then of course you don't even want him on your team. He's worthless in that case. But if you think he can just be serviceable as the best possible center fielder in all of baseball, why wouldn't the Yankees just traded for Aaron Hicks. Aaron Hicks is not the player that Jackie Bradley is, just defensively. Maybe he's a little bit better offensively, but I could never quite understand why there wasn't at least some value. I never thought the Red Sox should just dump him.
Yeah, I think there was some interest in Bradley, particularly after last year when, let's face it, his stock was down. Remember, he had spent a good part of August and the first part of September optioned in Pawtucket. And he almost had become an afterthought because by early to mid-August, he was hitting under 200. And good as he was, spectacular as he was defensively, it became harder and harder to justify playing him every day because he was essentially an automatic out, striking out, not making contact. He was just way over his head. If you recall, there was interest on the part of the Seattle Mariners, who play in a big ballpark in Safeco Field, and of course would be drooling at the prospect of Jackie Bradley Jr. being their center fielder, even if he didn't hit much more than he did with the Red Sox. And there was also interest from one Dave Dombrowski when he was general manager of the Detroit Tigers. Dombrowski revealed at this past winter meetings a month ago that he indeed tried to trade for Bradley the year before. Again, big ballpark in Comerica, maybe not someone fully formed offensively, but Dombrowski saw the value of having someone that good defensively. So I think there were teams that thought the Red Sox might have been frustrated with Bradley's lack of progression at the plate, and that maybe they could get him at a point where, you know, his value was sort of at an all-time low. They could get him on the cheap. But Cherington at the time was not interested in moving him. And I think Red Sox fans should be happy that Cherington didn't wash his hands of him at that time and had reason to believe that there was more there offensively, which we saw at least for a period last summer.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that a smaller mid-market team not only tried to buy low, but literally just tried to buy fair. Bradley has always had good on-base percentages and things like that. Now, granted, those dropped significantly when, like you said, he couldn't even hit off a tee. But in college and then in the minors at the easier levels, he's shown an ability to manage the strike zone and to get on base. Of course, AAA in the major leagues is a different story, and he really failed pretty miserably for the most part there. But there were signs there that maybe he would be able to figure it out with some time. I would think a team, like you said, the Mariners, just don't even try to lowball or don't even try to take advantage of maybe frustration. Just be fair. Just offer what he would normally be worth. I would have thought that he should have got some kind of interest at a fair price, at which point with all the Red Sox depth, they maybe would have agreed. My guess is the offers weren't very good. And what I'm trying to get to is, have you heard anything this offseason that Castillo or Bradley is gaining any trade interest outside? Because the Red Sox theoretically don't really need all of these outfielders, and then they add Chris Young to it. Have you heard anything that would suggest that maybe some teams have some interest in those two guys?
Oh, I'm sure they get calls on both, particularly Bradley, because at this point he's so cost-controlled. He's a 0-2 player, meaning he's not eligible for arbitration yet, meaning, you know, you can pay this guy $525,000 this year if you wanted to. Castillo's a little different because not only has he underperformed so far at the big league level, but he's due, you know, an average of $11 million here for the next five seasons. So there would be some risk in taking him on. There would be virtually no risk at all for taking on Bradley given his service time. And I'm sure that there were more teams before they solved or signed Price and traded for Smith. I'm sure there were teams that inquired about Bradley, but you know, the Red Sox for now are committed to you know, playing him in center field and hoping that what they saw in July and August offensively is more of what can be expected in the years to come.
And I love the hot stove season. I love the off season, all the rumors and all of this. But right now, we're about as boring as we're getting as we ever get in the off season. All these outfielders available, all these lesser players possibly being traded for, and yet nothing is happening. It seems like everyone's settled, which is we know is not even remotely close to the truth. But it feels like the Red Sox are done. Do they have any remaining needs they need to fill? And are they trying to do anything else? Do you see any meaningful, impactful moves in the Red Sox this offseason?
No, it doesn't seem so. And again, that was made clear by Dombrowski. By the time the winter meetings closed down in Nashville in the second week of December, he was essentially saying, I'd be happy going to spring training, you know, with this roster. And really, they've done very little beyond some minor league deals and invites to spring training to make anyone think that he wasn't being honest when he said that. I still think they could upgrade the bullpen a little bit. I thought that they should have been – I mean, when you look at how bullpens are constructed now and how deep they can be, you know, it's clear that it's sort of a measure of not only quality but quantity, as teams like Kansas City and the Yankees and other teams have these fully stocked bullpens with four or five terrific arms, even before you get to whoever the closer is. And I thought if the Red Sox had made a move on Darren O'Day or maybe a lefty like Tony Sipp, that that would have further solidified the bullpen and taken additional pressure off the rotation, where you kind of get into an area where the Yankees are now, where they have three closers, three power arms for the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings. Even if the Red Sox didn't go out and get those kind of names, I thought some additional depth and setup weapons would have been good moves for them. But it's pretty clear now with you know, pitchers and catchers reporting, I think, 4 weeks from yesterday, that they kind of are what they are, and that what you see is what you get.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, like you said, you can be better. The Yankees, I don't blame them for getting Chapman. I don't think they needed him. Their bullpen was so good last year. If they had kept Justin Wilson, I think they would have been fine. So I don't really think they upgraded that much, but it sounds like the Reds just threw up their hands and gave up and said, okay, we'll just take whatever bag of balls you'll give us for Chapman. And any team that takes that deal, I'm never going to blame them. For them, it just sounds like they gave up. The Yankees gave up nothing to get that final year of Chapman, and they get nothing but upside from that. So that was a good deal by the Yankees just by default. I like their bullpen as it is. I think it definitely helps, and with that rotation, they probably need even more help, like you said. But it is still a pretty good bullpen. It is an intriguing situation there, and
They, they've upgraded, certainly. I mean, the bullpen is worlds better than it was last year, simply by the presence of Kimbrel and Smith. Those are two significant pieces that they've added. I just thought that, you know, one more really would have put them on a level with Kansas City and New York, and whether it be budgetary reasons or whatever, they seem to come up a little short there.
Yeah, and maybe it's also because it seems like even though the Orioles don't seem to be doing anything, it seems like they prioritize Darren O'Day. So if he was one of the guys that maybe the Red Sox wanted to get, it seems like the Orioles were willing to go out and pay what you had to do to keep him, if he was an option for the Red Sox. It just seems like, I don't know why, but the Orioles aren't willing to spend on anything except for Darren O'Day, though they do have that pretty large contract sitting there waiting for Chris Davis to accept it.
Yeah, the Orioles are in danger, I think, of, you know, when you think about a team that was that won the division 2 years ago, that won, I think, 97 games, and eventually got beaten by the eventual American League champions in Kansas City, and to see how far they've fallen, they may get Davis back. Who knows? They did retain Wieters with the qualifying offer, and they did resign O'Day, but they've lost Wei-Yin Chen. They've lost the year before. They lost Markakis. You know, it just seems like that window is kind of closing for them, and it's hard to imagine they're going to be factors in the division next year.
Yeah, I talked about this on another podcast because we did the Orioles podcast earlier in the season, and I almost look back and say the Albert Bell signing has killed the Orioles' chances. I always feel like they're overperforming, but they seem to be undercommitted in the offseason. And so now they don't go out and they don't keep their pitchers. They traded Eduardo Rodriguez to us, which ended up being kind of a disaster. It seems like they're hovering in that middle ground, trying to be a contender without actually committing money in order to do it. And I think now it's finally catching up to them. Their rotation is not very good, and their offense is getting – they're not. I mean, if they didn't get Nelson Cruz on a steal of a deal, on a one-year deal, which is, of course, a deal they loved, I'm sure – if they didn't do that, they're not even that good 2 years ago. And then last year, they're 81-81, which I give Buck Showalter all the credit in the world. I think he does a phenomenal job. How he keeps the Orioles as competitive as they are with the diminishing commitment on the off seasons, I don't know how the Orioles do it, because I just don't think that – I think they're very, very, very hesitant about spending money and making a mistake like they did with Albert Bell. Maybe I'm going way too far back, but they signed a guy – You see them with all these medical now. Everyone fails their physicals, and they won't give anyone long-term sizable contracts, with a few exceptions. I mean, they did give Adam Jones, but he was a guy that they traded for and I guess technically did develop. He was only a prospect with them for a couple of years, but it seems like they're extremely unwilling, which is what the Red Sox were a few years ago, about giving anyone a contract more than 4 or 5 years and anything over $80 to $100 million.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Peter Angelos is a hard guy to figure out. He's extremely wealthy. They have a TV deal there that is pretty profitable for them. They clearly could be spending more money than they are, and yet they act like a very small market team. And they have two terrific players at the heart of their roster in Machado and Adam Jones, obviously. There isn't a team in baseball that wouldn't love to have either one of those guys, but there's a big drop-off in talent after that, particularly if they lose Davis, as it seems they're going to.
And I hate when teams do that middle ground thing, like, for example, signing Ubaldo Jimenez. They didn't spend $130 million to get him, but they spent more than nickels, you know, and it's very risky. I didn't like when the Red Sox, even though they did win a World Series, and again, I think that was more than a fluke than anything else, but that was a magical season, and it was great. But I don't like when you sign a Napoli to a 3-year, $35 million or something like that, or a Victorino to 3 years, $35 million. I don't like those half measures, and the Orioles seem to be living that way. And I just think maybe you hit it once in a while, but over the long haul, you're probably going to be more bad than good.
Yeah, it seems as if, you know, you need to make a determination one way or the other. Are you going to be about drafting and developing? And frankly, the Orioles haven't done a great job of that lately. They did develop Machado certainly as a first round pick, and he's developed into a terrific player. But it's kind of one or the other. You're either going to be competing for the best talent on the free agent market or relying on homegrown players and augmenting them once in a while, and it seems like the Orioles have this mixed identity right now.
Yep, and they had Jake Arrieta, and they weren't able to do it. They have Chris Tillman, who has had half seasons or quarter seasons of success, but hasn't really developed. And they've had these other starting pitchers who are really good bullpen guys, but never became the stars they were supposed to. Zach Britton and Brian Mattis were supposed to be very good starting pitchers. Now they're very good bullpen guys now, but you're settling when you do that. When Zach Britton and Brian Mattis are really good relievers, that means that they weren't able to make it as a starter, and so they're stuck with Miguel Gonzalez and Mike Wright, and the way they're developing Kevin Gausman confuses me. And Dylan Bundy, because of injuries, is a real problem. My understanding is that he has to be promoted now or could be left available to waivers, which would be a very hurt, damaging thing to his development. So that's another high-end talent that it looks like won't develop into anything like what he could possibly be. So that's good for the Red Sox, is that the Orioles don't develop all that well. And they traded for Adam Jones, so it's not like they drafted him and developed him. He was almost a finished product when they got him. So, and you could argue, if you want to be negative, a guy as talented as Manny Machado, who made it through their system so quickly, a guy like that maybe makes it regardless of how good or bad you develop anyway. I don't want to go that far, but you could make that argument in a lot of cases too. Bryce Harper was going to be a great player, I think, no matter what. You don't give the Nationals credit for that one. Same thing for Steven Strasburg. Yeah.
No, right, I agree. I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
Machado was kind of a can't-miss talent, a top five or six player drafted. And, if players like that, I mean, it's not to say that there aren't some busts taken that early in the draft, but when you get that opportunity to pick that high, you can't make a mistake. Seems like Machado was one of those guys that was kind of a no-brainer and has developed as expected and is a terrific piece for them. But the clock's ticking with him, too, in terms of free agency. And, are they going to step up and make the kind of commitment in another 3 years when he's eligible?
Yep. Let's look ahead to 2016 now. I don't want to keep you here forever, even though I would be more than happy to do it. But looking ahead to 2016, Henry Ramirez, again, he had probably a month of really good performance. Let me ask you that, because you've been covering baseball for a long time. You're an insider. You have these, you see things and know things and get a feel for things that all of us don't. What's the impact when you have a guy who seems to be lazy, seems to be immature, seems to be selfish, And those are the probably the more friendly things that you could say about Hanley Ramirez's attitude. How big of an impact? And people say chemistry is all about wins. Chemistry doesn't matter when you're winning, or it is good when you're winning, and it matters and it's really bad when you're losing. What's the impact of a guy like a Hanley? Is he truly a cancer, or do we just try to find an excuse and it's easy to fall right there? What from what you see, what's the impact of that type of player? Because the end of the season, they really performed well the last 5 or 6 weeks. It looks like because Hanley was gone that's, you know, one thing happens and this is the result, and therefore, you know, A caused B. That's not always
the case. Yeah, it's a hard thing to quantify. I don't know that you can sit there and say that, you know, that they won in spite of Hanley. They won when Hanley was in the absence of Hanley. I don't know that he was a tremendously destructive piece in that clubhouse. Certainly, I think there were veterans who were disappointed that he wasn't willing to put the kind of effort in to becoming a better outfielder. He seemed to make all the right commitments in spring training, and then once the bell rang and the game started to count, Hanley mistakenly thought, well, I've figured it all out. I've been doing drills down here for 6 weeks, so the rest of it is just about going out and playing, when obviously that wasn't the case. He was woeful in the outfield, and then worse, seemed unwilling to do anything to try to correct that. So that didn't go unnoticed in the clubhouse. Was it the reason that team was so bad in the first 4 months of the season? I'd say it was more about Hanley not producing offensively after the first month that you referenced, when he hit, you know, 10 home runs and had an OPS of 900. It looked like he was at least going to make an effort to out-hit the demerits that were brought by his bad defensive play. But once he stopped hitting, then he wasn't contributing at all. I think that, as you referenced, sometimes people can put too much emphasis on chemistry and how various personalities fit in. I would suggest that their upturn in the final 6 or 7 weeks was less about Hanley not being around or in the lineup and more about the pitching getting better and the young players getting some confidence. But it would certainly help if Hanley were more accountable and responsible in his second year.
And it looks to me like I think they're going to have to probably dump one of these contracts. And when I say dump, literally maybe pay all of it. I don't see how, with all the young players, you also have Hanley Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval on the field at the same time. Granted, David Ortiz, this is his last year, so maybe they can squeeze them all in between first base, DH, or whatever. Maybe they can. But to me, it seems like a pretty big year, and maybe a decision-making year for both Hanley and Pablo Sandoval. Pablo only hits, left-handed now, can't hit right-handed. His defense, while people love to say he's a, you know, I was watching the movie Ty Cobb the other night, and Ty Cobb was in the car with his servant and the writer Al Stump, and he keeps criticizing Babe Ruth over and over and over, and they say, can you give Babe Ruth any credit at all? And he says, he ran pretty well for a fat man. That's essentially what Pablo Sandoval's defense is. It's like he's pretty good for a fat man. I don't know if he can still defend third base for a normal non-fat person, but I don't know how much longer he's going to be able to play third base. What are you expecting from, A, Hanley Ramirez this year? Is he going to be able to stick at first base? Because if he doesn't, it gets really tricky to find places for these guys with David Ortiz still there. And what are you expecting from Pablo Sandoval? He's been declining for more than 3 years now, so people shouldn't be shocked that he had a bad season last year. Now, it probably shouldn't have been as bad as it was, but we signed a declining player. So to think that he was going to come here and be an all-star was an absurd expectation, but nonetheless, there is room for improvement from him. What are you expecting from both of those guys?
Well, I guess with Sandoval, I'd be better able to answer that question when we see him in spring training and see what kind of shape he's put himself in. Reportedly, he's been working hard to lose some weight and get into better shape. We have heard this before, of course, or at least the Giants heard that before. When he was in San Francisco, and some years he would come in shape, and some years he wouldn't. Even the years in which he came in shape, reported to camp in decent shape. Eventually, the weight started to creep back on over the course of the season. So I think a lot with him, you know, this guy's still 28. He shouldn't be in decline. He should be in the prime of his career. 28 is hardly ancient by baseball standards. If you want to talk about 32 or 31, then you're starting to slide down the other side. But, you know, I don't know that they should be, quote, prepared, unquote, for him to continue to regress. If he comes into shape, he should be a guy that plays slightly above average defense, who can hit 275 and, you know, hit 15 home runs and knock in 65 or 70. That's, again, I said at the outset, I think they overpaid for him, given that the Giants were, you know, trying to retain him and the Red Sox had to match that dollar for dollar. He's not a $19 million a year player, but he can be a useful and productive player if he puts up those kind of numbers and commits himself to better conditioning. As far as Hanley, I think it's more difficult to quantify. You know, a lot of it is about attitude and commitment. If he puts the time in at first base, then I think he can be league average. You know, he's never going to win a gold glove over there. But as you referenced with Ortiz in his final year, they can get away with, if they can just make it through this season with Ramirez, then he can be shifted to DH for the final two or three years on his deal, and then you don't have to worry about what he's doing in the field for the most part. So I think the hope is that, you know, he's a little less bulky, he's a little more flexible and athletic, and that he continues to put the work in first base, not just in spring training, but after the season starts as well, you know, learns the footwork, learns about the cutoffs in the outfield, can dig some throws out and save some errors for his fellow infielders. It's all about getting through 2016 and then sliding Hanley into that DH spot after Ortiz retires.
All right, now you've put the qualifiers on there. You set the framework to determine whether things go well or things go poorly. Now bring us to your conclusions. What do you think we'll actually get from Hanley, and what do you think we'll actually get from Pablo production-wise and performance-wise in 2016? Which way do you think those things fall?
Well, I think they both will be better than last year, although that would not seem to be difficult. You know, the arrow almost has to point up, given that these guys are relatively healthy and, you know, not at a point where their career should be over. So I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that that Sandoval, you know, is kind of a 275, 330, you know, 440 guy, and that Hanley is capable of, you know, being a pretty good run producer in the American League. And while it might not be reasonable to expect that he's going to hit 10 home runs a month and have a 900 OPS like he did in April, that he's certainly capable of those months, can deliver 25-plus home runs and an OPS north of 800.
And one of the reasons why I didn't have a major problem with the Hanley Ramirez signing was because he does have that upside. And if things do go well with this team, it seems like Hanley Ramirez is more likely to be engaged and more likely to be at least somewhat disciplined and at least a little more likely to be a positive force on that team rather than a negative. And that's why I didn't have a problem with that deal, is that the upside there with Hanley Ramirez is intriguing and makes for, and if things are going in the right direction, I think he could be a part of that. Pablo Sandoval, as much as you throw out those numbers would be some of his better numbers going all the way back to as much as 2012. I don't think Sandoval can do that. I mean, going back as far as 2011, he has declined every single season since, from 315 to 283 to he actually batted 278 and 279 in consecutive seasons. So he didn't technically decline in that period, but I don't see him being able to get to an on base of 330 or a 440 slugging. That 440 slugging would be his best since 2012. That's my concern, is that people think he can do that. And like you said, at age 28, he should be at least, if not in his peak years, let's say peak years happen younger now because players get promoted earlier. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. I've never done the analysis, but he hasn't had a 440 slugging since 2012. And so that's my concern, is that he's just not going to be able to do that. If the one thing I guess is a saving grace is the Red Sox don't really have a viable third baseman to replace him. So as long as his defense isn't disgraceful, and I don't think it will be, I think he can be a decent third baseman for Fat Man, as I said. He can be a solid defensive player, even above average a little bit. So his position is safe there. I'm just afraid that we're actually going to maybe not get a decline, because like you said, it's fantastic to have a low bar. And he hit 245 with an OBP of 292. So the bar is very low. But he can't hit right-handed anymore. So anytime there's right-handers out there, that's going to be a problem. How do you get to 275 when you can't hit left-handed pitching? I'm sorry. And so that's my concern, is that while he should be better than 245, we may only be looking at a ceiling of like 260 with an OBP of like 310. You look at Billy Hamilton, the criticism of Hamilton was that he may only get on base at a 300 clip, and therefore he won't be able to steal 50 bases. Well, Sandoval doesn't hit enough home runs. He doesn't run at all, and he may have an on-base percentage of 300 to 310 or 315. That's my concern, is we may have dead weight out there.
Well, I mean, that's entirely possible. I'm certainly not projecting that Sandoval is going to be, an all-star and MVP candidate this year. I just think that, for his age chronologically, there's no reason, if he got himself into shape this winter, and we'll know that in another few weeks, that he can't, see those numbers improve significantly. But, that's on him, obviously.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. What you're saying, I totally agree. I was throwing out my opinion of what I think we'll get. Not that I definitely was not disagreeing with your analysis, absolutely. Let me ask you about Dustin Pedroia. A couple years ago, it looked like he took a hometown discount. Now you see what he's doing on the field, and I think a lot of it is the fact that he's a warrior and he just refuses to take time off when he's injured. But nonetheless, what looked like a hometown discount now looks like a bad contract, and that seems to be the case. Some really large contracts end up looking reasonable. I mean, when they extended Wade Miley, people said, what the heck were you doing? Now, all of a sudden, one of the compliments for the Mariners was that Wade Miley's under a reasonable contract and a manageable number. So it's weird how contracts change drastically year to year when they weren't all that different. But nonetheless, Pedroia's got a reasonably sizable contract. He can't seem to stay healthy, though he does stay on the field. What are you expecting from Pedroia in 2016?
Well, that's hard because, as you mentioned, it seems like each of the last three or four seasons have been compromised by injury. First, it was a series of hand issues. He had the wrist and thumb that certainly hampered him for a couple of years. And then when it seemed like he was starting to drive the ball a little bit more the way he did a few years ago, last year, he has the hamstring issue, which sidelines him not once but twice. It seems like he came back too soon after the All-Star break and paid the price and essentially didn't play much in the second half. So, he's into his early 30s now. This is not about commitment or preparation. He wants to play and plays as hard as any player in the game, but that may also be more of a curse because his style of play has probably contributed to some of those injuries, or at least in the case of last year, perhaps trying to come back too soon, an eagerness to help this team, which ultimately hurt him and the team by coming back too soon. So I think it's hard to project what we're going to see until we know how healthy he's going to be. And I don't mean the existing injury. The hamstring certainly seems to have been healed. There don't seem to be any question marks going into spring training, but it's a history we've seen the last three seasons where invariably there is something that detracts from his performance on a physical basis, and that's the kind of thing you can't project. I think the Red Sox are committed to being a little more judicious when it comes to playing time, and they'd be happy playing him 145 games instead of 162. And I think reluctantly, Pedroia has come to acknowledge that that's probably best for him in the long run. But he's a hard guy to set expectations for, principally because you don't know how healthy he's going to be and how many games he's going to be able to play at full strength.
And I almost think he's a victim of expectations as well. Somehow he got lopped in with the Robinson Cano as far as the offensive potential at second base. Red Sox fans would say they would rather have Pedroia than Cano, but if you look at the numbers, Cano's numbers are so much better than Pedroia's, it's not even really close. We may want to try to compare them offensively, but they're really not. In 2011, he had 21 home runs and he stole 26 bases, batted .307 with an OBP of .387. He never had done that before. He's never done that since. But I think we saw that player and thought, wow, this guy can be a almost a number three hitter in a star. But the one thing about Pedroia is he, for the most part, he plays a lot of games, at least 135, other than 2015. He pretty much has played that for four consecutive seasons before that. But he hits, I mean, in a down, in what you could probably call a down year in 2014, he still batted .278 with, in the most importantly, an OBP of .337. So even while he's hobbled, even while he's struggling through injuries, he still gets on base, he still makes contact, he still hits for a good average, and I still think he's at least average, if not a plus defender. So I think if you expect 20 homers and 20 steals, your expectations are wrong. But if you complain about you get from him, you really shouldn't be. He hit .291 with a .356 OBP. That's one of the best offensive second basemen in the game. His slugging was .441. His OPS was .797. Even in years where he's playing hobbled, those numbers are really good at that second base offensive position.
Yeah, I think if you take where he was headed, and he was on pace to come pretty close to that 26 home run or 21 home run season last year before the hamstring intervened in July. I think he had, 10 or 12 home runs through the first couple of months and was on pace to, hit 25 homers. He doesn't need to do that to be a valuable member of that team. It's kind of a bonus. But, if you could get 15 to 18 home runs out of him in that second spot, along with a pretty good play at second base and some on-base percentage, and that's still incredibly valuable.
Yeah, I really do think he's better than we realize. That doesn't look like a horrendous contract, or he doesn't look like he's an anchor to our failures or anything like that. .278 with a .337 on-base percentage is gold. I mean, look at what the Yankees are dealing with at second base. I mean, they may end up playing, they had maybe Starlin Castro with that trade become something, but you look across the league, even if you are expecting so much more, Dustin Pedroia is still one of the best offensive second basemen in the game, and I don't think anyone thinks he's had a good season in the last three. .301, .278, .291 the last 3 years, batting average-wise, and an OBP of at least .337. He's a lot better than I think we give him credit for, and that contract looks, though he will be on the team until 2022, that's a long time, but offensively I think he's better than we realize.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's still, when he's on the field, he's still a well above average player. It's a matter of how often that happens.
Yeah, and he did only play 93 games last year. And like you said, he played 135 the year before. He did have 12 home runs last year in those 93 games, so definitely. Transitioning over to the rotation and the bullpen here, it seems like the trend of baseball, and we may see this as a blip in the radar, or maybe this is a trend that's going to continue going forward. I'm actually working on a piece right now talking about how teams are going to transition to not allowing these mediocre pitchers. It seems like there's a lot of mediocre pitchers out there. It limits the number of years you need to sign them. It limits how much money you need to give them, and it makes the bullpen more important, which is also a more affordable place to spend your money. My opinion is that we're going to see a lot more teams stop allowing their starters to go a third time through the lineup. So we're going to see a lot of five-inning type of situations where a mediocre starter will not face a hitter a third time. To me, that's the trend of where baseball is going. If you're going to do that, and the Red Sox had a lot of problems with this early last year, it seems like every single game they were down 7-0 by the third inning, and obviously you just don't win when that happens. Can this rotation, obviously you expect a lot better than that from David Price, but can the rest of the rotation below that at least keep them in the games so that their bullpen can help them also win it? Do you think the rotation and the bullpen in combination in 2016 can do that? Or are they going to be the disaster that they were at the beginning of last year, which, like I said, every single season we were down, every single game we were losing 6-0 by the third?
Yeah, I think that the improvements made, in addition to Price, and we talked about that at the start, taking some of the pressure off the other starters. I think deepening the bullpen and giving them more weapons to get to Kimbrel in the ninth will also have a rollover positive effect on the rotation. Think of it as recently as last year, Junichi Tozawa was sort of the main eighth inning setup guy. Well, as you go into this year, he's probably the sixth inning guy, because now you've got Kimbrel in the ninth, Koji in the eighth, Smith in the seventh or eighth, and you could go to Tozawa as early as the sixth inning, and you don't have to, you know, push him to 75 appearances and use him four or five times a week, which I think resulted in him kind of burning out in August, as we've seen the danger of that happening each of the last 2 years. So the more weapons you have and the opportunity to use somebody like Tommy Lane in the role in which he should be used, that is almost a lefty specialist, things were so bad last year that they had to allow Lane to face right-handed hitters, and that's not something he did very well. But he limited lefties to a batting average well under 200. So I think there's a domino effect here. You know, Koji doesn't have to close anymore. Now he's the eighth inning guy. Tozawa doesn't have to be the eighth inning guy. He could pitch as early as the sixth inning. Guys like Ray and Lane, who are best used in non-high leverage spots, can now be used in those spots. So I think all of that takes some of the responsibility and pressure off the rotation and gives you a much more valuable 1 through 12 pitching staff where everyone benefits by the additional depth.
Do you think Koji will be the eighth inning guy? Because with how hard Carson Smith throws and with his strikeout per nine ratio, you know, the hard-throwing strikeout guy, not a lot of contact against him, it seems to me he's the natural eighth inning. But then again, with his stuff, maybe you want to bring him, you know, you hear the sabermetrics guys always say that you want to bring a guy in at the most leveraged time, and a lot of times the most leveraged is the sixth or seventh, not the eighth or ninth. Do you think Koji's the eight, or do you think Smith eventually becomes the eight and Koji's the seventh, and like you said, maybe Tozawa's the sixth?
No, I think they go into the year with Koji as the main eighth inning weapon. That doesn't mean that can't change. It certainly doesn't preclude using Smith in the eighth inning on some nights. I mean, Koji's going to be 41 when the season starts. It's not as if you're going to run him out there three nights in a row. So there will be nights, certainly, that Farrell goes to Smith in the eighth inning. And you may even see Smith used more in the middle of an inning when you need a double play because he's so good getting ground balls. But I think Koji's the guy that will be the principal eighth-inning setup man, at least to start.
Yeah, and some guys are more flexible than others, too. Like you said, an age definitely plays a role there. Let me ask you about Eduardo Rodriguez. Right now, at least on depth charts, he's listed as the number four. But, I mean, again, Clay Buchholz at his best is probably a number two, but he's not at his best very often. Do you think Eduardo, he had a decent season as a rookie, 121 innings, 98 strikeouts, 3.85 ERA, 1.29 whip. You'd like to see a little bit better than that at the top of a rotation, but for a rookie, that's not a bad first season, especially in a year where the Red Sox really struggled. What do you think we get from Eduardo? And by the end of the season, I don't think he'll be slotted as the number two, but by, say, midseason, is he pitching like our number two?
I think that possibility exists. I think everyone agrees that this guy has a high ceiling and that he hasn't reached it yet. I mean, he's only made, you know, whatever it was, 22 major league starts. It's unreasonable to think that he was going to come in and dominate right from the beginning. But I think he can be that guy who grows into, if not a true number one, then certainly, you know, a very dependable number two starter. The thing that I think you saw with him, particularly in the early going, it became less of an issue in September, but there were those inconsistent starts where he'd give you two or three really good ones and then, get rocked for five or six innings and be gone after three or four. Take a look at the ERA he compiled in losses and then contrast that with his ERA in wins. I think if he learns to limit those really bad starts to one out of every eight, nine, or 10 instead of once every three or four, then, you know, that growth alone will make him that much more valuable. And I think it is reasonable, or maybe not reasonable, but possible that by the second half of this season, he could be their second best starter behind Price.
And the Red Sox were ranked 25th in ERA last season with a 4.31. that obviously is not going to get it done. And to get inside the top, let's say 12, or let's say like the Toronto Blue Jays were, that you need an ERA of around 3.80. You need about 87 wins to get into the wild card, maybe 8 or 89, depending on where, you know, certain teams fall. But last year, the Yankees were the worst wild card team in the American League with 87 wins. What does this rotation need to do, or who is the key to this rotation in order to, for the Red Sox to at least get to 88 wins and get a wild card, never mind possibly win the AL East?
Well, I mean, I think the key sort of sits somewhere between Porcello and Buchholz. You know what you have in Price. You expect that Rodriguez is going to continue to make some progress and improvements. And Kelly, if he can harness that command, is at the very least a number five guy with some upside who could be better. The where things I think are going to be determined is what they get out of Buchholz and Porcello next year. And if they can get, you know, somewhere close to 30 wins from those two guys in the second and third slots, then that obviously would offer you a rotation that, you know, could be one of those top 10 or top 12 rotations in either league.
And looking at the prospects, does a Henry Owens or a Brian Johnson, do either of those guys have a shot at, if not, maybe making the rotation out of spring training, but let's say not then, maybe in June or July? These guys, it's not like this rotation is loaded with talent, but there's a lot of arms there. They even added Ronis Elias in that Seattle trade. So they've got Owens and Elias at 6 and 7. Kelly is 5. Rodriguez is 4. Pacello, Buchholz, and Price. I mean, they've got 7 of those, and then another Brian Johnson being 8. Could Owens find a way to get into that rotation quicker, or what do you think, I guess, who's the 4 and 5?
Well, if we've learned anything, we now know that it takes a heck of a lot more than 5 starters to get through a 162-game grind. And, you know, the number's probably closer to 10 than it is 5. If you look at the numbers in baseball the last few years, you have to have depth in the rotation. You know, you need only look at somebody like Rodriguez from a year ago, who, you know, didn't even make his first start until Memorial Day weekend late in May, and then becomes arguably their best starter over the final 4 months. So I would think that both Owens and Johnson would play roles here. You don't know how big those are going to be or who they're going to have to pick up slack for. Are they filling in for guys for injury reasons? Are they slotted in because of guys underperforming? There's a lot of unknown, but certainly those guys, and I would throw Stephen Wright into that too, as someone that's, you know, is probably going to be counted on. The question is, you know, are those guys making 6 to 10 starts, or are they making a lot more because something in the rotation has gone wrong, either issues or performance?
And Michael Kopech's a name we hear a lot. He hasn't really pitched at very high levels, but you hear a lot about the arm. Is there a chance he's in this bullpen in any meaningful way this season, or is he a prospect we don't see for a while?
I would be surprised. I mean, this is a guy who hasn't pitched above high A. And I know guys, as you've said, take a much quicker route to the big leagues now than they ever have. And you know, using guys you know, in the bullpen to kind of get their feet wet, the way the Red Sox have done in recent years, is not unprecedented, but not for a kid taken out of high school, you know, less than a year and a half ago. I think Kopech, you know, particularly having missed 50 games last year with an amphetamine suspension, that's valuable development time that he didn't get. And so I wouldn't see – to me, there are almost no circumstances under which he pitches in the big leagues this year, nor should they.
And I think we learned that lesson from Mr. Hansen about a decade ago, where if you rush a guy,
yes,
even as a reliever, you can do significant damage. I don't think they want to do that to Kopech.
No, he's a, you know, he and Anderson Espinoza are probably the guys with the highest ceiling in terms of pitchers still in the minor leagues, but they are both very young, and I think the Red Sox want to be careful that, you know, that they observe some innings limits in their development, that they don't take too big a jump, both in terms of the workload and the level at which they're pitching.
You've been amazing taking all this time out. I apologize for rambling. We got two final very quick questions. Again, I apologize for keeping you so long here.
One is
the prediction. What is your prediction for this season? Give me a record. And I realize I will hold you to it because I love to do that. But I realize it's very difficult to predict an actual number. But nonetheless, it is the Powerball season. What do you think record-wise? What do we see from the Red Sox?
Well, hopefully I have a little more success in picking this than I did in Powerball numbers because, frankly, if I had hit last night, Chris, I might have been difficult to track down for this one today. So
I wouldn't blame you at all.
I'm going to say they're going to be right at that 87-88 win mark and very much in contention for a wild card. I don't know that they're going to win the division. In fact, I don't think they will. I think Toronto's probably a little better. And maybe even the Yankees factor in there. But I think it'll be an improvement of about 9 or 10 wins over a year ago, and that would be a significant step forward for them.
Absolutely. To go from 78 wins and really a season that was over in June to 87 or 88 and at least in the running in September, where these days you don't have to pay a lot to get an impact play. You see what the Jays did with David Price. That rotation was relatively mediocre. They added a few pieces at the end of the year in trades, and all of a sudden they go to the playoffs. So that's very doable these days, though with all the people, so many teams are in contention now, that can be tough. Just to give you an idea about the Powerball, I had 5 tickets. I believe, there are 6 numbers. I was looking at the numbers, and I think I had 30 numbers in my ticket, and I only had one number. Not only did I not win,
but
I only had one number.
That tells you what you're up against and how hard it is, to win this when you can buy a handful of tickets and only have one number out of 30 of the 5 or 6 that were winners. So it's fun to dream, but that's about all it is.
Yeah, I was like, there are 69 numbers, I think, in the combination. I had 30 numbers, and I don't even think I had any repeats. And yet the 6 numbers, except for one, fell within the 39 that I didn't have. So, I hate the Powerball number, that bonus number, only it wasn't the Powerball number. It was like in my normal set. So like the number 10 was the only one I did.
Yeah, they don't give you credit for that.
No, not at all. I wasn't getting any calls or apologies or congratulatory phone calls from the state of Massachusetts on that. Not whatsoever. And I didn't expect to win, but to be that miserably bad was a little bit disheartening, to say the least, especially now that 3 people have won, or it looks like 3. Final question, we're going to let you go, and this is maybe the most important question of the day. The podcast name is A Podcast to Be Named Later, so I like to give every guest an opportunity to actually name the podcast. I want to give you that chance. What do you think the podcast name should be?
You know, I like it as it is. I know that's kind of an easy way out, but everyone understands that phrase, to be named later in baseball. That's also Theo Epstein's charitable foundation. I don't think you have to change it. I think it's kind of catchy as it is.
And that is a common opinion, and I'm going to take that as sincere. I'm not going to say that you're brown-nosing the host. I'm going to take that as a sincere opinion.
That's my honest take on it. I don't think you need to do anything.
I appreciate it. Sean McAdam, thanks a lot for coming on today. Again, all this time you put in with us. You don't have to. I know you're a busy man, but we love what you bring to the show and really appreciate you having on. Thanks again for taking so much time to talk some Red Sox baseball with us today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That's Sean McAdam, the Red Sox insider from Comcast Sportsnet New England. You can see him on television in Boston. You can see him in post. And if you want, just follow him on Twitter. He does some great work for baseball. And he writes for, as I said, Comcast Sportsnet. Follow him on Twitter, at Sean, S-E-A-N, _ McAdam, M-C-A-D-A-M. Again, at Sean, _ McAdam. You can also go over to Comcast Sportsnet New England and read his content there directly. But talking some Red Sox baseball with him today, fantastic day. Love having Sean on the program. Hopefully we'll have him back. Again, he's a Red Sox insider But I would have no problem having him break down any of the Major League Baseball teams individually. And if he's not worn out from his 90 minutes of effort today, then maybe he'll come back and talk to some of the other baseball organizations as we go through our 30 teams wrap around here. We're trying to preview every single organization, looking at their 2015s, looking ahead to their 2016s. So we're going to be continuing doing to this. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. You've been listening to a podcast to be named later. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at CJMitch73. If you'd like to follow the podcast, you can head on over to Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. God forbid we'd go by the same name. If you want to read my fantasy content, you can always do that. It's at rotoexperts.com. If you want to read my baseball writings, you can go over to minorleagueball.com. And also, I write about fantasy sports over at baseballamerica.com as well. So lots of different places to find me. I'm more than happy to talk baseball with you if you'd like. The easiest way to do that is follow me on Twitter. Contact me if you want to know where to go or what to do, at CJMitch73. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be talking Yankees and Tampa Bay Rays next. We've already done the Blue Jays, the Orioles, and the Red Sox. We're going to finish out the AL East with the Rays and, of course, the hated New York Yankees coming up next week. So tune in for our podcast. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Everybody be safe and have a good January.